earthworms are pretty common in Wisconsin, especially with all the rain we've had. You seem to be a lot more prevalent. On this part of the show, we're going to take a closer look at earthworms. And since it's Invasive Species Awareness Month, we'll focus attention on a fairly new intruder to Wisconsin, the jumping worm. And a couple of guests for you today. Bernie Williams is an invasive plants and earthworm specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And as well, Drew Watermullen, who is with the Bureau of Environmental Analysis with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Drew, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to focus on worms, and you may have some questions as we move along today. And if you do, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Bernie, you're a worm specialist. How does a person get interested in worms to begin with?
I started with a lot of snakes, invertebrates, turtles, and we just, at one point, we wanted to see what they were eating, so to say. So we started doing some earthworm surveys, and I've collectively been with earthworms about 14 years now. So,
wow.
I've learned a lot. You learn a lot from earthworms. They're a lot more interesting than people think. And I'm lucky that I work at the DNR with Drew, and he's another earthworm
another
colleague.
Earthworm guy.
Yeah.
And you're with the Bureau of Environmental Analysis. Drew, talk about your role.
Yeah, so I manage part of the research functions at the DNR. We were previously part of the Bureau of Science Services, and I was responsible for managing the coordination of invasive species policy for the department. So when Bernie discovered jumping worms in Wisconsin, it became an opportunity for us to work together on things that we hadn't previously had the opportunity to work on.
That's pretty cool. There are quite a few species of earthworms, are there not, right here in the state?
So, right, we have about 21 European species of earthworms, and in 2013, we stumbled across the jumping worm, which is an Amynthis species, which is not a European species, it's an Asian species of earthworm, and we had originally thought that this particular worm wouldn't be able to survive in Wisconsin, given our harsh winters, but unfortunately, we learned we were wrong.
Why are they such a problem?
They're different than European earthworms. European earthworms tend to be a long-lived animal, you know, a night crawler that people may put on their fishing hook. You know, it can generally live 8 to 10 years. So it's a long-lived animal. Whereas jumping worms, they're more of an annual. They're like the marigold of the worm world. They come for a season. They produce a lot of seed. In their case, they produce a lot of cocoons. They mature roughly in about 60 days. We've had a warm winter, so there's been microclimates under mulch piles, leaf piles. So they've been hatching, you know, since March, and I'm sure other ones hatched earlier in the winter, too, when we had those significant warm-ups. But right now, we're at the end of June. We have adult worms in the soil. We have some juveniles in the soil. But then once they reach adulthood, they start shedding cocoons. Those cocoons start hatching. And so by late August, September, that's when we run into issues where people start to call us at the DNR and say, I have worms all over the place. I've never seen anything like it. Last year we had an area which was really amazing for someone that likes worms. And after I went to see it, I immediately went back and got Drew and said, it's so exciting, Drew. You've never seen anything like it. And he agreed when he went out there, too.
So what, it was a pile of worms or what?
No, I mean, these worms are, you know, they reproduce asexually, so they're parthenogenic, so they don't need to mate. And so once those cocoons start hatching and then they become mature, then they start shedding cocoons and it just sort of feeds into the population growth. So you can get two generations, potentially three, during a growing season. So that's when you have worms all over the place.
And they look like a, you know, the typical garden worm that we... What do they look like?
They do resemble a night crawler. I mean, if you looked at that, you would know it's an earthworm. The difference is when you think about a night crawler, there is a band, near the head end of the worm that sort of encircles the worm, and that's called the clitellum. That's an area that's important in the reproductive process of the earthworm. And in Amynthes, that band is not raised. So on a night crawler, if you were to slide your fingers along the night crawler, when you bump into that clitellum, it's raised above the surface of the rest of the body. But when you do that on a jumping worm, it's smooth. Your finger would run right over it, and you wouldn't even notice that it's different than the rest of the worm's body. They also are a slightly different color. Most of the European earthworms are a brown or reddish brown. A few of them are lighter colored. The jumping worms tend to be gray or black.
Okay.
And then they behave very differently.
Yeah. So they jump.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's pretty easy to distinguish them from the other non-native worms that we have.
Well, Jeff in La Crosse has a question for us, so let's go there. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I'll turn it into two questions. First, what are our worms? You know, like what species or order or something like that? And then, because I know they don't fall under wildlife or like birds. So, and then the other one is why, when it rains, mostly at night, you come across a parking lot, I mean, sometimes you can be quite a ways away from any grass or anything, and you find the worms all over the pavement everywhere committing suicide.
Yeah. All right, Drew, let's turn to you.
Yeah, so biologists classify earthworms as a group of organisms called annelids, and these are worms that are segmented. Okay. So when you look at the worm, you see distinct segments along the length of the body that sort of repeat. And so that's how we treat them scientifically. And within that group, we call them oligochaetes because that has a that's a reference to the fact that they're lacking hairs,
okay,
if you will. Okay. And then in Wisconsin law, we don't treat them as wildlife. They're not considered wildlife. And only the jumping worm is considered an invasive species. So that's the only one of the introduced species that we have that fits the definition that's in the statute for what an invasive species is. And so we regulate that as a restricted species under the invasive species law.
And then what about this whole business of when it rains, You see, there's a specific species of worm, isn't it, that comes out when it under those conditions? Or
well, they all come out when it rains because basically the earthworm's body is acting as the lung. So when they come up after a rain, they're essentially coming up out of their holes, their tunnels, because they're drowning. So they have to come up to breathe. And so frequently, rainstorms, you know, if you're watering your lawn a lot, you'll see a lot of worms coming out. And they come up at night because they don't have any pigment. So they can't really hang out in the sun and, you know, sunbathe themselves because, you know, that's sort of like a vampire. They just can't do that. So they often come up at night. They're social animals, so they do like to socialize. So we'll frequently get people calling and saying that I have worms all over the ground. What are they doing? They're socializing. They're just like us in many facets.
Very interesting. Thank you, Jeff, for calling. Let's go to Brianna in Vesper next. Hi, Brianna. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm actually driving across the state with my family, and we're listening to the segment. And we've been talking about doing a vermicompost bin in our house to kind of learn about composting and worms a little bit. And I was just curious if when it came time to collect the worms or the compost, I just didn't want. I think we use redworm in those bins.
Yeah.
But if any of the worms got into the soil, I didn't want to be in trouble for causing another invasion. And so I didn't know if any worms did get into the soil, are they the ones that would even survive in Wisconsin, or is it something that we should maybe reconsider even doing?
All right, that's a good question. Drew, do you want to take that?
Sure. So the best advice would be to collect your worms locally. If you're going to, it's fine to use worms in composting. They're very efficient at making that process work. The only issue you run into is if you're actually dealing with jumping worms, because the jumping worms are the only ones that are regulated under the law. And what the law says related to jumping worms is that it's not okay to transport them or to introduce them or to help them propagate. So if you collect worms locally and they're not jumping worms, you're fine.
Okay.
All right.
So the worms that we were looking at were ones that we're going to be ordering online. So you're recommending not doing that then?
I don't recommend ordering online because you're not always certain what you're going to get. And so I recommend collecting locally.
Okay.
All right.
We'll look for some local sources. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And when we're talking about transporting, one of the issues that has come up is with local plant sales or purchasing plants. You need to be a little careful with that, don't you, Bernie?
You do. So the plant sales, I mean, plant sales are wonderful things that take place across the state all spring and summer. And I think, just in speaking with so many people involved in their the Master Gardener groups, the plant sales in various counties, it's, you know, some of them have taken steps where, you know, if you're a member of a particular garden club and you're going to take part of the plant sale, they actually have done self-inspection of their members' yards the fall before the plant sale and taken stock whether or not they have the worms or not. One example, the Hardy Plant Society in Madison, it caused quite a bit of a stir because they canceled their plant sale this year, and it's a well-known plant sale, and it's large for the area, but many of their members had jumping worms, so they self-reported, and they knew that they had jumping worms, and so they didn't want to spread the species. So for them, it was proactive for them to cancel, but for other areas of the state, you know, if you don't have them, your members don't have them, your plant sales, just be aware of what you're purchasing. It's buyer beware. So, I mean, if you're purchasing a plant, you can always pinch that container that it's in and take a look at the soil, take a look at the roots. But, you know, plant sales, you just want to be careful. Know what you're purchasing. Ask questions.
That makes very good sense to me. Well, we have lots of callers online with questions for you. And we are going to take just a quick break, so just stay online. Elizabeth, you'll be up next from Madison. But our guest today, Bernie Williams, invasive plants and earthworm specialist with the DNR. Drew Watermolen is with the Bureau of Environmental Analysis with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Call in 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're all about worms on this segment of the program with our two guests, Bernie Williams, invasive plants and earthworm specialist with the Wisconsin DNR, Drew Watermolen with the Bureau of Environmental Analysis with the DNR. So great to have both of them here today. And lots of questions online. I want to go to Elizabeth and Madison next, but if you have a question, you can call in at 800-642-1234, email at ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Elizabeth, thank you for waiting, and what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you. My call's actually a bit similar to the last one with the plant sale. I host a plant exchange in early spring, and I didn't have it this year because of the worm. And I'm wondering, I would really like to have it again. And I'm wondering if I had people bring their plants bare root and had, you know, trash cans full of water or something that they could rinse them off before they brought them on my property. Is that a good strategy since most of the cocoons would have hatched by early May?
Bernie?
Yes. So one of the things that you can do, and what some, I'd say several plant clubs did this spring, is that they asked their members to try and bring their plants as free of dirt as possible. And then when they did get to the designated facility where they were doing it at someone's house, they had bins to wash the plants off. The thing that we learned this year is that the cocoons are, you can't see them with your naked eye, so you're not going to be able to find them in the soil. We do know that the cocoons need the medium of the soil to move. So if you do clean your plants, and there's really no soil left on there, and then you repot it into like a soilless mix, you're pretty safe that you're not going to move those worms. Another thing that you can do is also ask your members, have you seen signs of the worms? Do you see that change soil signature? Are you seeing lots of worms? And just have them look this fall in preparation for next spring. So just, thinking ahead will really help slow down this worm quite a bit.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate your call. We had on Facebook, Brianna had a question. What's the difference between native and non-native versus exotic and invasive? Drew, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. So we get this question a lot because the terminology can be confusing. So native species are species that, just like it sounds, are native. They occurred here. They occurred here naturally without human intervention or human-assisted introduction. Non-native are species that are not found here on their own. And those non-native species could be non-native to Wisconsin, but from other places within the United States, or they could be non-native coming from another continent. Exotic means the same thing.
Okay.
Exotic is non-native.
Okay.
Invasive, we use that term to talk about how an organism behaves in a new place. And in Wisconsin, there's actually a definition for invasive in the state law. And it's pretty straightforward. It says that we consider species to be invasive species if they are non-native and they have been demonstrated or have the possibility of creating ecological harm, economic harm, or harm to human health. So that's a very specific classification that we use for the purposes of regulation.
All right, let's go to Joseph then in Madison for our next question. Hi, Joseph. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question. I do remember back in the day when we dissected worms. And I remember that one of the things that I had learned was that worms have a nervous system. And over the years, I'm also a fisherman. And I was wondering, Does a worm have, feelings as of, pain when you would use them as bait?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for that question, Joseph. Worms have a nervous system. It's a fairly simple nervous system. It essentially consists of two groups of nerve cells that are called ganglia. And they are located at the head end of the earthworm on either side of the mouth. So basically, they have two very simple brains, if you will. And then the nerves extend out of those ganglia, and they join, and they form a nerve cord that runs down the back of the worm to the tail. So that's the structure of the system. They do... earthworms do perceive changes to their environment. They sense when people are touching them or holding them or prodding them. I don't think a psychologist would say that they feel pain. And the reason I say that is because the way we understand pain is the presence of certain nerve cells that are called nociceptors, and earthworms don't possess those. Those are fairly unique to vertebrate animals. And so when you're putting the hook through the earthworm, yes, the earthworm feels it, but they don't perceive it as pain the way we perceive pain.
Interesting. Ah. Very interesting. I've often wondered that myself, as a matter of fact. And Joseph, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. We have Bob in Columbus up next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, one of it's been answered that why are the worms out in these wet nights? You've been told they're socializing. The other thing is when you run across them on the roads, which I have numerous times, they're always crossing the road. They aren't going down the road, or I'm not meeting them head on.
Yeah.
How does something that's 1/8 of an inch tall know which way is the shortest way across the road?
Well,
they aren't navigating by the stars because it's cloudy.
Are you sure? Maybe by the moonlight?
Oh, man. Is there any answer to that question?
I think it's an interesting question, and I don't have an answer.
Right. I don't have an answer either. They're not following the stars like the birds or anything like that, but they do know that when they're crossing the roads, they are trying to get to shelter. They're looking for food. They're looking to try and get out of that habitat and under something to cover them.
Yeah, but as to why they would take the shortest route?
Hey, worms are really smart. They've been around for roughly 700 million years. So, you know, maybe they're a little more advanced than people give them credit for.
Yeah, possibly. Thanks for that question, Bob. On to Ken in Mayville next. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So we get our mulch from the town mulch pile, and we definitely found some jumping worms in it. After shoveling mulch, I was like commenting to my wife about how crazy these worms were, and we found a few in the mulch, poked at them, they ejected their tail, passed all the tests. I pulled whatever ones out that I could have and saved them to take to the DNR, and then they drowned in one of the recent storms. A couple questions. But first, I haven't been able to find any more, although I find a lot of little baby worms, but they seem to be red or darker brown at the size that they are. And then also, is there a way of eradicating them once, and are they going to spread to the rest of my garden, or am I pretty safe to just keeping them in this one area that I found them in the yard?
Okay, so... Well, if you got them all, you're probably okay. But Bernie, the chances he got them all, are they?
Those mulch piles. When I give a talk, sometimes I have a picture of a mulch pile, and I have a warning sign. Those mulch piles are great, but sometimes you get a lot of surprises in them. So you can get worms, you can get invasive plants. In your particular situation, I would monitor the mulch that you have, and I would try and isolate it in one area of the garden that you have it, so I wouldn't spread it around, and I'd keep an eye on it. I would pick any worms that you see out of it. So, I gave myself worms at one point, so I picked them out of an area. So you have to be diligent about, like, really looking at your soil, looking to see what's happening there, and just trying to remove them. So you can remove them from the soil. You want to do that because then you're going to prevent them from shedding cocoons in your soil, which will lessen the population. You could also... look into a propane torch. A lot of homeowners have been telling me about that. So you just buy a little torch at Menards, $30. You can get rid of them that way. So just sort of heating up your soil a bit. But if you're not seeing them all over the place, I would concentrate on that one area where you did see them. And I would monitor that on a weekly basis just to see what's going on.
Yeah. Okay.
So just a couple of follow-ups on that. I wanted to point out that some of our colleagues at the University of Wisconsin are doing some field tests and some research on control methods. So right now we can't recommend a specific control method, but there is research going on to help figure out what might work.
What might work.
And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, if you are hand-picking them out of your mulch, the best thing to do is to just put them in a garbage bag, tie off the garbage bag, and leave it sit out in the sun so they bake, and then dispose of them in the landfill.
Okay, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Ron in La Crosse has a question. Let's go there.
Yeah, I always hear this. If you wanted to start a worm farm, to raise worms, that you should use coffee grounds, probably mixed with soil. Why is that, if it's true?
What is it about coffee grounds, or is that just...
It's convenient organic matter.
Yes.
It's available.
Yeah. And the worms have preferences on what types of food that they like. They love leaves. So if you have an abundance of sugar maple leaves, any leaves that are full of like sugar, carbohydrates, potassium, they're going to enjoy that. So you don't necessarily need coffee grounds, but it's organic.
It's handy.
Material. Yeah, very handy.
Okay, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Ron. Janice in Madison is next. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I was wondering, I haven't heard anybody say why you don't want jumping worms in your soil.
So,
Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, so the jumping worms, as Bernie described earlier in the show, they have a relatively short life cycle, but they grow very fast. And in order to grow very fast, that means they need to consume a lot. And so they radically change the structure of the leaf litter in the soil in the places where they invade. So we have seen sites in a maple forest where there is essentially no leaf litter left on the ground by the middle of the summer. So we have all the leaves fall off the tree in the fall. They're covering up the ground. They begin to decompose. They provide an important habitat for a lot of seeds that germinate in that duff layer, that leaf litter layer. And when you have jumping worms, the jumping worms consume that entire layer in a very short time, and they eliminate that habitat for those other species that rely on that. And so we're very concerned. Right now we're sort of lucky because most of the places that we know jumping worms occur in Wisconsin, they're in urban areas. They're not in our natural areas or our more pristine woodlands or grasslands. But we're concerned that if they get there, they will fundamentally change the ecology of those habitats because they eliminate that litter layer. And that really is a critical layer. For example, our state tree, the sugar maple, its seeds germinate in that layer and develop the seedlings that then spread their roots that go into the soil. In the absence of that litter layer, those trees can't reproduce.
Yeah.
And so we see fundamental changes in the structure and the composition of those forests. The jumping worms also change the way that nutrients cycle through the soil. They change the way that water flows through the soil, and they change the way that soil is aerated. And those are all important things for the biology of those systems. So that's why we're concerned about them.
So if you have them in your vegetable garden, are they going to change your soil so much that you won't be able to grow anything in it?
They will change the soil to a point where you will need to add mulch or other nutrients to the soil in order to be satisfied with your gardening experience.
Yeah.
Okay. So, if I buy bags of topsoil every year to put in my little gardens, they should be protected.
You might want to, you probably need more of a soil amendment at that point.
No, I usually put some compost in it and some.
Yep. So, yes. I mean, like you have to feed your soil because they're churning it over so quickly and they're really, they're degrading it to a point where you're not going to get the yields out of your garden that you would anticipate.
Yeah.
So they could pretty much ruin a flower garden because you're not changing the soil.
Yeah. So one quick anecdote. Bernie received a call from a landscaper who had been mulching her plantings in her own yard, and she was very frustrated because over the course of the one summer she had to mulch four or five times because the jumping worms completely eliminated the mulch.
Wow.
I usually go buy bark at some company that supplies bark. Do you have to worry about getting bark from those places now?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the main thing that you want to be aware of is, you know, if you're approaching a landscaping company or, you know, in the green industry, you know, that's their industry, and they pay a great deal of attention to what's going on. And, you know, just ask them questions. They've all been informed about jumping worms. We've gone to their conferences. We go to their field day. They've been involved in developing BMPs to address the slowing the spread of jumping worms. So I think, you know, just ask them questions. Many of them have the BMPs there. You can also find them on our website at the DNR. So the jumping worms have their own page. And that page is being updated presently. So there'll be more pictures, more recommendations, some of the papers that are being written, and some of the research that's going on at the UW in regards to trying to control them through different mechanisms.
If you go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've got a video, I think from the DNR, of jumping worms. And you can, so you get a good look at the worms and how they react. Mm-hmm. And I think that'd be a good, not obviously you can go to the DNR site, but if you're on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, take a look under the posts and you will see a video of the jumping worms. And they're not a lot of fun.
Right. Well, until that, I'll just preface that video. So we did that video. Somebody else in Forest Health with me, Colleen Robinson, we went out to the Arboretum and we collected all those worms in the course of 10 minutes. We were just sort of scooping them off the soil surface, and then we brought them back, and then we did a video of them. So you can see how active they are.
Yeah, we're looking at it right now, and they are really worming around.
Right, and these are really unique worms. And this, so we left those worms, I left them in my cube in a bucket over the weekend because we had filmed that on a Friday, and when I came back on Monday morning, they had popped the lid off of the bucket and they were all over the DNR. So when we say that they jump, we're not kidding. It's a very wild behavior, and they can escape.
Yeah, they look like they're under a lot of they're jumping and wiggling, and they've with a lot of force.
Yes.
You know, Drew, you were talking earlier about them getting into forests, and we have had problems not so much with the jumping worms getting into forests, but other worms that are creating problems for some of our large tract forests.
That's right, Larry. What a lot of people don't realize is that thousands of years ago, glaciers came through Wisconsin and eliminated any worms that would have been here. So over the last 10,000 years since the glaciers receded, our forests and prairies and other native habitats developed in the absence of earthworms. So species native to North America had not colonized our forest. And so with Euro-American settlement, we brought in earthworms for a variety of reasons and in a variety of ways. And as they have become established in our forests, they have altered the soil structure, and they have eliminated that leaf litter. They've essentially done the same things that we're concerned about what jumping worms do. They've just done it at a slower pace. And so one of the things that Bernie and her colleagues have done is they have surveyed stands throughout the northern part of the state in particular, and they've identified some places where there's a discernible impact from the earthworms.
Oh boy. How long do the worms live again?
So their life cycle, so potentially, you know, if you had some that were hatched out in March, they're adults now, so it takes about 60 days for them to reach maturity. We do know that we have two species in particular within the genus in Wisconsin currently. So we have Agrestis, which tends to be about 8 to 10 inches long, and then we have Tokiensis, which tends to be a bit smaller, so probably around 4 to 6 inches. But in between that, we know that there's other species out there. We just haven't positively identified them. But they have a very quick life cycle, like Drew mentioned. So they're not going to hibernate during the winter like the European earthworms, and that sort of gives them the leading edge. They're able to produce so many cocoons, and then they overpower the European earthworms. Another interesting thing about jumping worms and European earthworms. Once you get jumping worms, you're hard-pressed to find European earthworms. Whereas when you're looking at surveys, you can always find a variety pack of European earthworms. But once the jumping worms move in, it's only them.
Well, I tell you what, this has been most interesting. And we have a lot of callers online yet, but we are out of time. But I want to thank you both. Hopefully you guys will come back and be with us again. That was fun, and I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did too.
Sure. Be happy to. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Bernie Williams is the invasive plants and earthworm specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Drew Watermullen is with the Bureau of Environmental Analysis with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And we'll get them back and we'll talk with them again. Tomorrow on the show is going to be fun, too. We'll take a closer look at fireflies with the author of the book, Silent Sparks. It's a really cool book, and I know you're going to enjoy it. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.